for argument this morning is Williams against Lapine. Mr. Eichmar.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Irene Dimkar. I represent Michael Willis and Kendrick Owens. Michael was 14, Kendrick was 16 when they were falsely arrested on a Sunday evening, an early Sunday evening in front of their homes in a neighborhood where they knew everybody. Everybody knew them. A police sergeant lived across the street. Michael's family owned the house since 1980. His mother, grandmother, sister, handyman lived at the house. Kendrick's family owned their home since 1986. His mother, grandmother, stepfather, sister, brother, aunt lived at the house.
You really need to get to what matters in this case. This is not about his life history.
Well, Your Honor, it's all in that context that...
Look, there was a jury trial in this case. Your client lost. You need to make legal arguments about why the district judge abused his discretion.
Your Honor, first of all, we in several ways we've said that we're entitled to a new trial. We brought a motion to set aside the verdict because of the comments that were made by the defense counsel in summation. I understand that usually comments in summation do not give rise to reversible error, but we contend that what happened here was so outrageous that it is like the Davis versus FMC Corporation case, where what was said in summation was prejudicial and hurt the case. And what the defense counsel said was, after they said on their summation for three times that the plaintiffs were liars, that there were 30,000 reasons why they'd be lying, they were embellishing, they were part of a drug operation. On my rebuttal, I said, if there were evidence of this, you would have heard it. And that's when the defense counsel blurted out, we're not allowed to introduce that, the evidence the plaintiffs were gangbangers and were doing drugs. Counsel knows that. We can't bring that to the jury. So defense counsel deliberately and intentionally planted in the jurors' minds that there was evidence of a criminal record that they weren't hearing about. There's evidence of the plaintiffs being gangbangers that the jury wasn't hearing about. And the intent was to poison and prejudice the jury, and that's exactly what happened. The district court ruled on our motion to set aside the judgment, said that these comments were highly improper because there was no evidence that these two young men were gangbangers or doing drugs, said that the statement was untrue, it was a lie, but still she said that she wasn't convinced that the misconduct prejudiced the plaintiff. And our contention is the plaintiff was prejudiced. It's not like we could reopen the case at that point, at summation and try to disprove what was being said. Yes.
Let me try again. Your brief has proceeded, and your argument so far has proceeded, as if we were going to make a decision about whether your client is prejudiced or not. That's not the issue before a court of appeals. You made this argument to the district court. The district court decided not to order a new trial. The question on appeal is whether the district court abused its discretion. And you need to address the appellate standard of review rather than argue this case as if we were going to make an independent decision.
I understand. Well, I would turn then to what we're asking for de novo review of, and that is the standard use on the motion for new trial. We said the district court erred in applying the same standard to a Rule 59 motion as to a Rule 60 motion, and we're relying on the Mejia case, was decided 7 days before the opinion was rendered by this judge and actually involved the same district court judge. And what the district court ruled here, and this is what was the error, that the plaintiffs were able to fully and fairly present their case at trial, so there should not be a new trial. And we're saying if you follow Mejia, which was decided, of course, last year, yes, we understand that district courts usually stuck with the same evidence that the jury considered, but the district court is supposed to have to get a general sense of the weight of the evidence, the credibility of the witnesses, and the comparative strength of the facts. In other words, the district court's supposed to have an opinion about the case, about the credibility, about the weight of the evidence. And the district court did not render its own opinion. This opinion is supposed to be independent and neutral. It's not to be in a light favorable to the defendants. And analysis wasn't done by the judge. We're asking for de novo review. The right standard was not used. And that would either give us a new trial or a remand for reconsideration whether there should be a new trial by the district judge. We say that the district judge erred in its ruling and never got to the point whether there was it was against the manifest weight of the evidence, the
did
verdict.
Did you preserve that argument?
We did in our motion. I understand that the defense is saying that we didn't say it as clearly as we could have in the motion, but the motion does say that we're asking for a new trial and twice mentions that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. The credibility here, of course, is really important. We're saying that it's not credible that these two young men would be hawking drugs in front of their own homes, plain view of their families, family friends, and longtime neighbors, especially with a police sergeant living across the street early on a Sunday evening. But there was no the evidence was such that there was no surveillance. There was no surveillance. It was made up. And we tried to show that at trial, that that there was a delay in time. The 911 call came in at 6:37. It was acknowledged at 6:49. Police officers swore twice that they appeared on the scene at 7:35. Any information they had at that point was stale. It was 58 minutes old. They admitted there was quite a bit of delay. We eventually got there, they said. And they're saying that maybe the 7:35 wasn't an exact time. But even if it's off, they still don't have enough time for surveillance. It was not possible for them to have a surveillance. We also said that
the surveillance on the alleged two sales?
Yes, yes.
They testified that they watched these occur with Thompson going to and from the vacant lot, right?
This is what they said. They said they drove to somewhere. They drove by, and they recognized Brandon Thompson as being the person they were looking for because of the white stripe on his shoe. He was 6 inches taller than the description, wasn't dressed the same way, but they said because he had the white stripe on his shoe, which Glowacki admitted, defendant Glowacki admitted, you know, everybody has those kinds of shoes. And I'm not sure if he's talking about a stripe or a swoosh, but, you know, that these Air Force shoes, you know, are worn by a lot of young men in Austin. So they drove to somewhere, but they don't know where they drove to. They parked the car. They didn't know where they parked the car. They had a surveillance. During the depositions, they didn't know where the surveillance took place. Then at trial, Lapine said, well, I went back to the scene. Now I know I was between 5530 and 5534 West Congress Parkway. And then we called in the police sergeant who lived a door or two down, and we called the mom of one of the plaintiffs, and they testified that there were two dogs that lived there. Not just that they were let out to run in the gangway, their doghouse was there. Two Rottweilers were in that gangway.
They fenced in?
They were fenced in the gangway, and the police officer said that they hopped the fence and they were in the gangway.
So they hopped over a fence where the dog was supposed to be. Is that
right,
what you're saying?
Right. They would have been in the gangway with it. They didn't know that. They came to trial as in.
How high is this fence?
The fence is about chest high.
Really?
Yeah, was there chest high?
Those two cops hopped over there.
Well, we do make a claim that there couldn't have been a surveillance because they couldn't have done everything they said they were going to do. Park the car, go to the alleyway, jump a fence, get into the gangway, see two drug sales, jump back out, get in their car, and it just couldn't have happened. And what they said about what they saw, too, they said that they saw Brandon Thompson sell something to two individuals. But they didn't know if the two individuals were on car or on foot. They didn't know whether what the sex was. They didn't know a description of people. They didn't know which direction they came from. And what they claimed was that Michael and Kendrick, who were in front of Michael's house, that they called out X once. They said they recall once to a passing car that didn't stop. And then they were arrested, of course, for conspiracy to sell a narcotic. But, you know, the evidence just wasn't there for the defense. I mean, there was just no surveillance. It was not possible time-wise because of the delay. Any information they had was stale. The description didn't match. And then there wasn't any possibility for a surveillance. They were too vague on that, something that they made up later. So we're saying, okay, the judge was there. She heard the police officers. She heard Michael and Kendrick testify, their mothers testify, the police sergeant testify, the woman who was coming back from the from the restaurant. She saw the police officer looking with a flashlight, going up to Central with a flashlight, looking for drugs, which is what Michael and Kendrick said happened. They said, you know, we weren't involved in any drugs, but we saw the police officer going to the corner looking for drugs.
Is that when they were in the car?
That's when they were in the car. And Shanetta Kersey, who is a friend of the family, is walking up the street, and she sees the police car. She doesn't know until she gets there that Michael is in the car, but she sees a police officer doing this, looking, you know, going all the way up to Central, which they denied they did. So what happened, and I'm getting into my rebuttal time, is that the police officers made up the surveillance. They got some kind of a call and somehow felt that they had to have an arrest. They grabbed these young individuals. Maybe they thought because they were juveniles that, you know, they could arrest them, somehow get, you know, credit for the arrest, but, you know, that there wasn't going to be any great consequence to them. But to these two individuals, these two young men, this was devastating for this to happen in their neighborhood. And we've mentioned, you know, we had permission from the judge to bring in that Michael Willis, you know, that he was mentoring a football team of younger people, younger boys in the neighborhood. Some of them lived in the neighborhood. This was devastating to them. I do want to get into the issue of the high crime area. I will save that for rebuttal, though. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hubbard.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. None of the three issues raised by plaintiffs in this appeal are reasons for a new trial in this case. As the first reason raised by plaintiffs, the District Court did not abuse its discretion by denying the Rule 60b-3 motion here, where a single objection during closing argument did not prevent plaintiffs from fully and fairly presenting their case at trial. As this Court has recognized repeatedly, improper comments during closing argument rarely rise to the level of reversible error, and that is especially true, whereas here, the District Court provided cautionary instructions to the jury on how to deal with those comments. As the District Court recognized in its decision here, it specifically instructed the jury after closing arguments that it should not be influenced in any way by any objection made by counsel or any other comments made by counsel. The District Court also specifically instructed the jury that it should not consider statements made by counsel to be evidence in the trial and told the jury that before and after closing argument. Here, this was merely a brief moment within the rebuttal closing argument of a three-day trial. It was, as the District Court recognized, plaintiff's counsel had an opportunity to immediately correct any misimpression that was made by the objection in front of the jury and did so, and the Court immediately overruled the objection. For these reasons, the District Court did not abuse its discretion in determining that plaintiffs were not prevented from fully and fairly presenting their case at trial by this one objection.
The instructions that you've referred to were not in the nature of curative instructions for this particular objection. They were just part of the Court's general instructions, as I understand it, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. There was no specific request for a curative instruction involving this objection made at trial.
What did the Court say when the objection was raised? Just move on or something? Overruled, go ahead, something like that.
Well, what happened was the objection was made, and then the plaintiff's counsel actually made an objection to the objection in front of the jury and said, Your Honor, I object to that. There's nothing here, meaning there is no evidence that these are bad kids who are involved with gangs and drugs. And in response, the District Court immediately said, overruled, and then allowed plaintiff's counsel to continue her rebuttal argument, at which point she continued to tell the jury that there was no evidence of the plaintiff's bad character and that the evidence that had come into trial was to the contrary, that these were, in fact, good kids from good families who would not have done what the officers said that they did. So that's how that occurred at trial. Turning to the second point the plaintiffs have raised on appeal, which is the Rule 59A motion, the District Court likewise did not abuse its discretion in denying that motion either. Plaintiffs contend here on appeal that the District Court erred by failing to apply the proper manifest weight of the evidence analysis to that motion. However, when this Court reads the motion, it will see that it is merely a five-paragraph cursory motion that does not actually even suggest to the Court that this verdict in particular was against the manifest weight of the evidence, let alone develop any argument to support such a position. It's true that the motion did cite case law stating that a District Court may grant a motion for a new trial where a verdict is against the manifest weight of the evidence or where, for other reasons, the trial was unfair to a party. But at no point did it actually develop any argument that this verdict was against the manifest weight of the evidence. And indeed, the only argument set forth in the Rule 59A motion was the incorporation by reference of the Rule 60b-3 motions involving the attorney misconduct that's been alleged.
One thing that confused me, I guess, is in focus on this, once arrest, the strip search. The police said there was no strip search. The boys graphically describe a strip search. I obviously, without seeing a trial or understanding or whatever the jury sees or believes, I guess it's all about credibility. That's, I think, what they're trying to focus on here, because it is, that is just really strange to me that cops say there was no strip search and they graphically describe one. I guess the jury's got to believe one or the other, I guess.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the jury heard testimony from the plaintiffs regarding the purported strip search and heard the officers testify diametrically in the opposite, that there was no strip search, that they had not conducted a strip search, that they generally do not conduct strip searches, nor do they conduct searches in the manner generally in which the plaintiffs had testified. And it was up to the jury at trial to determine which side to believe, and the jury credited the officer's testimony on that point and apparently on the other points, too, that were in, that were contradicted between the two sides involving the events surrounding the arrest. And for that reason, the jury had a rational basis for its verdict in any event. Even if plaintiffs had asked the court for a manifest weight of the evidence review, it would have been an abuse of discretion to grant that motion on that ground, because the jury here had a rational basis for its verdict in crediting the officer's testimony about the arrest and the strip search. Quickly, I'd like to address plaintiff's argument to the that the court should have applied a broader standard in this case under Mejia and other cases. To begin with, plaintiffs rely on these cases like Mejia, in which a party actually did ask the district court in its post-trial motion for a manifest way of the evidence review and developed that argument to the district court. As I've explained, that was not done here. Moreover, plaintiffs misread Mejia as somehow calling for a new, broader, searching, independent, neutral review of the evidence in every single Rule 59A motion case. However, Mejia said no such thing. What Mejia actually held was that in that particular case, the district court judge had erred by applying the impossibility standard to a normal Rule 59A motion where there was no impossibility issue in the case. And this court said that by applying that rule, that impossibility standard where no impossibility issue existed, that the court had failed to conduct a neutral evaluation of the evidence as requested by the plaintiffs in that case. Here, what the court in Mejia did not discuss was prior case law from this court, including the King case from 2006, which we've cited in our brief, and the Whip case from 2008, that clearly states and holds that a court must evaluate the evidence in a manifest weight of the evidence review in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs in any event. And the court made no statement in Mejia that it was trying to overrule those prior cases. And I'll turn quickly now to the plaintiff's last contention on appeal for reversal, which is defense questions about drug activity in plaintiff's block. And those questions also did not constitute reversible error in this case. Plaintiffs have raised a number of questions that were asked at trial on cross-examination of various witnesses regarding drug activity on the block and claim that that's error. But it should be noted by this court first that plaintiffs only objected on motion in limine grounds to a single line of those questions at trial and therefore failed to preserve any of their other alleged errors for review on appeal.
The motion in limine that's at issue on this aspect of the appeal was just a prohibition on the reference of this neighborhood as a high crime area.
That's correct, Your Honor. The ruling that was entered before trial said that it barred any reference to the plaintiff's block in which they lived as a high crime area.
So it didn't prohibit any inquiry into drug activity in the neighborhood. This was a drug call, after all.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So those kinds of questions weren't prohibited. The terminology high crime area was. Is that right?
That's right. That's what the order said, Your Honor. And indeed, if plaintiffs had thought that the questions were somehow otherwise violative of the order, then they should have objected to trial to alert the court to that, to allow the court to decide whether or not it had intended something broader. But they did no such thing, with the exception of one line of questioning asked to Mr. Willis's mother, Janice Jones Willis, on cross-examination. So they're really, these questions were not even necessarily violative of the order to begin with.
What about the discussion of Thompson? I don't know to what extent that went on, but he is obviously, that was where the jury raised the question, wonder what happened to him. He was, the thing that I guess I was sort of surprised at is that there was, that it was any block about his own record and what happened in this case, which would have obviously greatly, I'll use the word prejudice, their case, because it showed that he was legitimately arrested and convicted. Now, that was not allowed to come in, right?
Well, again, what the ruling pretrial actually prohibited was any reference to Mr. Thompson's prior convictions for drug offenses or his guilty plea in this particular case. And the questions that were asked and about which plaintiffs now complain on appeal actually were a set of two different questions. There were two questions that were asked of Mr. Willis on cross-examination regarding whether Mr. Thompson had filed a lawsuit against the police or whether he was a plaintiff in this case. Neither one of those questions actually referred to Mr. Thompson's guilty plea or to his prior convictions. Plaintiffs even failed to object at the time that those questions violated the motion in limine, as they now argue on appeal. The other questions that were asked about Thompson were a natural part of the narrative of this trial because it was undisputed among the parties that Mr. Thompson was present at the scene of the arrest and was arrested at the same time as plaintiffs, and yet he had not brought suit or had not otherwise participated in the trial as a witness as the district court as part of plaintiff's own strategy to keep him from being impeached on the stand, which the court said would be allowable. Now, the questions about why Mr. Thompson was there at the scene were proper because on direct examination, the plaintiffs testified to Mr. Thompson's innocent reasons for being there and the innocent things that they were doing with Mr. Thompson at the time of the arrest. So it was only natural on cross-examination that defense counsel was going to ask questions as a follow-up to try to impeach the veracity of those statements where the defendant officers were testifying that they had seen the plaintiffs assisting Mr. Thompson to sell drugs at the time of the arrest. One more comment on the questions about the drug activity on the block, and I'd like to point out for this court that plaintiffs are hard-pressed here to argue that any of those questions were prejudicial to them at trial because they themselves asked questions about drug activity and even gang activity on the block, which was not asked by defense counsel in the first instance. Specifically, defense counsel asked Officer Lepine on cross-examination whether he and other officers in the area had received complaints about drug sales on this block from members of the CAPS program in the past. Defense counsel asked whether there were gangs in the Austin neighborhood and specifically asked whether the gangs controlled the drug trade in the neighborhood in the way that Al Capone's gangs had done in the past. That elicited actually an objection from defense counsel on grounds of plaintiff's own motion in limine on the high crimes area evidence. And during a sidebar on that issue, plaintiff's counsel did not assert, as they do now on appeal, that their questions were required as a response to the defense questions about the neighborhood, but rather told the district court judge that they were asking those questions to develop their own affirmative argument to the jury that there were gangs in this neighborhood that controlled the drug trade, that plaintiffs were not members of those gangs, and therefore would not have been out selling drugs that day. And indeed, in their closing argument, plaintiff's counsel actually argued to the jury that the officers, as tactical officers, should have known who was and who wasn't a member of the gangs in the neighborhood, and that plaintiffs were not members of these gangs or drug dealers, and therefore their arrest was false.
Well, the officers didn't actually know Thompson either, did they?
They did not know Thompson prior to this arrest. There was no testimony that they did at trial. So for all these reasons, Your Honors, unless you have any further questions, the defendants would ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Ms. Dugmar?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, regarding the motion for a new trial, our motion could have been drafted better, but I contend and submit to the court that it was good enough. We did ask for a new trial under 59A. What I did was I incorporated information from the other motion, and I probably should have set forth the facts in the motion for a new trial. But the district court does have some role here. The district court is supposed to say something about the weight of the evidence, say something about the credibility of the witnesses, not just say the jury must have believed the defendants. In other words, the district court, my understanding of Mejia is that the district court is supposed to have an opinion, an independent opinion, neutral opinion of what the judge sees and hears.
The court is not obligated to develop your argument for you, and I think that's the material point here, is that you made the Rule 59 motion, but you didn't develop an argument on the ground of the verdict being against the manifest weight of the evidence. There just wasn't any argument on that. And so the court cannot be expected to develop it for you.
We set forth the facts in the motion.
That's not an argument.
we're asking, if I could go to the high crime area, because I want to make sure I do hit that, and our argument is that there's a cumulative effect here of all the different things that went wrong in the trial. And our motion regarding high crime area, if you look at our motion, it was to keep out any evidence, any reference, any argument about high crime area. And I think the defense is mincing words when they say, we didn't use the words high crime area. And yet they went forth and questioned every single witness about, are the people on the corner selling drugs? Do you see people wave people down? They asked the mom of Michael, oh, you're a CAPS person, you're a community person. How many times have you called in for drugs? 20 times, 50 times, 75 times. I objected twice. Twice I asked for a sidebar. The purpose of the motion in limine was so that I wouldn't have to do that. And yet, because you're not supposed to make a show in front of the jury. And then the jury starts thinking that, you know, that you're trying to hide something.
What about this argument that you opened the door by your own examination of witnesses about the gang drug activity in the neighborhood?
That is absolutely incorrect, because after they got in through the plaintiff's witnesses that this was a crime-infested, drug-infested area, we had a shift in strategy and said, okay, then what we're going to do is show that when it comes to drug surveillance, these officers don't know diddly. They don't know how they're supposed to conduct it. They don't know who they're supposed to be going after. That was after. I mean, what else is a trial attorney to do when they've opened up this door and you've got this, you know, all this information in front of the jury now that this is a crime-ridden area, this is a drug-ridden area. So at that point, yes, then we started asking them, did you see, gang activity? You know, isn't drug dealing usually associated with gang activity? But the court granted our motion in limine. And the defense counsel decided to ignore it. And then when I objected, asked for a couple sidebars, the judge, she told the defense counsel to move on, like you're belaboring it, never really ruled on, you know, the problem that there was with the motion to eliminate. And when I asked for a sidebar the second time, I said, it's because there's a problem with it, you know, a violation of the motion to eliminate. Just quickly about Brandon Thompson, that was a motion to eliminate too. He was asked whether he was a party to this action, implying, of course, he's guilty. So it was all this backdooring of the judge's motion to eliminate, and the judge even said so. She ruled regarding Brandon Thompson that was not proper. She said it wasn't prejudicial. She was not going to reverse the verdict. But she said, you know, they were trying to get in what I told them they couldn't get in, which was that he had pled guilty. So what they did with the high crime area with all of this was they stoked the fears of the jurors. And most important, in a neighborhood like this one, they were trying to show that there was a lesser amount of probable cause was needed to arrest the plaintiffs. And so I'm asking you to look at the cumulative effect of all these errors. Thank you. And to grant, give us a new trial.
The case is taken under advisement. Next case for argument this morning is Young Kim against the Commissioner of Internal Revenue.